You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 97. And tonight I have with me John Wheeler and Kelly Taylor.
Good evening. How you doing?
Hey, everybody.
Okay, John and Kelly, tell a little bit about yourselves, because not everybody listens all the time.
I'm not sure how to introduce myself. I've got 21 years nuclear experience, although I'm currently a work-at-home mom.
And I'm a marine engineer turned nuclear engineer, and I've spent about 15 years operating nuclear power plants, and the last 10 years doing things like training and workforce development, and now I'm focusing on workforce planning for the future of the industry.
So you're out looking for people?
That's a little bit of my job. What we're really doing is setting up and developing partnerships with colleges and technical schools to train the workforce of tomorrow. I have about a dozen partnerships around the United States that I'm working on with a number of other utility partners to do things like train radiation protection technicians, maintenance technicians, pipelines for operators for fossil and nuclear plants, things like that.
Yeah, that's a big deal, because not very many people think about getting into those kinds of fields. So many people are more encouraged to go to college and study political science or something like that.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. And part of the strategy that we have is getting the word out, because when the young people and guidance counselors and parents start to understand the kind of career opportunities that are available for young people, it really kind of changes their tune. We're working with one partnership in Idaho State. It's with Idaho State University, and over the last 2 years we've set up an energy education and training center out there. And the first class of graduates finished up this past June. I think there were about a dozen. I can't remember the exact number. They all learned the trade of being an instrumentation and control technician. And every single person got a job offer. Most of them got up to 6 job offers. And all of the starting salaries were $60,000 per year. And this is for associate's degree.
Yeah, absolutely.
People.
An instrumentation and control technician is an excellent career.
Yeah. You know, so that's just one example of a partnership that's gained momentum very quickly. And a good part of the curriculum that was put in place there came right from one of the nuclear power plants. So we took the instrumentation and control initial training program and provided that to Idaho State, and they incorporated a good portion of it right into their curriculum.
So what kind of stuff should somebody study in high school, or what should they focus on in high school if they want to go towards those kind of training programs?
You know, math and science really are the things that they need to focus on. And it's really not so much, you know, the math is very important. And did I lose you guys?
No, you still have me, but Kelly just dropped out. So I'm
Kelly dropped out? Okay.
I'm going to call her back in.
Yeah, the math and science is very important, but it's really more of what you're capable of learning more than what you learn. But you know, certainly math and science is really going to be a focal area.
Hello, Kelly's back.
Oh, hello, Kelly.
Thank you.
No problem. So John was telling us that math and science was the focal areas for somebody who wants to get into something like a control technician training.
And I tell you, it's kind of a field that if you think about what they do, and I guess a lot of people don't know what they do, but if you're interested in computers, but you like the hands-on approach to computers, you like to build computers or tinker with them, or if you like math and science and maybe are attracted a little bit towards the engineering, but you're not really sure you want to go really heavy duty into the math that's required to be a design engineer. If you like working with your hands and like working in teams rather than by yourself, it's a kind of career for somebody like that.
And, now, when you talk about math and science, though, does somebody need really heavy advanced math, calculus and analytical geometry and all that kind of stuff, or is it lower-level courses just good
the college, arithmetic? Yeah, the college courses teach them the calculus. And so I would say if somebody would just have algebra in high school, but have the capacity and the desire to be able to make it through some basic calculus in college, that would be enough.
At this point, we had a communications failure, so you notice a jump in topics. Back to the show.
Rod just asked me how things went on the West Coast. It was a pretty interesting conference. It was a lot of really, really neat stuff going on.
Now, this is the ANS meeting this week, right?
Yeah, this was the American Nuclear Society annual
meeting. Good, because I didn't want to miss this part either.
Yeah. And I, actually, before I get into the meeting itself, Kelly, I wanted to share with you, Rod is too modest to bring this up, so I'm going to bring it up. You know, Rod received a presidential citation from the American Nuclear Society this past week. And that's a really big deal. I wanted to read aloud what the presidential citation says.
Yeah, I want to know. Tell me.
Yeah. It says, presented to Rodney M. Adams for his commitment to bringing a greater public understanding of nuclear energy through discussion of the many facets of nuclear generation in a way that the general public can interpret. Mr. Adams has brought many voices of the controversial nuclear energy topics together in a way that is accessible to the public through his company's publication, Atomic Insights, the Atomic Insights blog about nuclear energy, and his podcast, The Atomic Show, dated June 2008.
Oh, that is awesome.
So congratulations, Rod.
Thank you, John.
I got a question I'll bring up with you later in the show about that.
Okay. Yeah, it was it's a big deal and very well deserved. Really, congratulations again.
Absolutely, it is really well deserved. Anybody that knows Rod knows that nuclear issues are some of his favorite topics, and he can talk about them on all levels with all people. It makes it very easy to understand.
Well, it's good to have people like you around because all my friends are bored with me.
Oh, I don't know about that. Don't you count us among your friends?
Oh, that's true. I mean, I should say my family. The people who have to hang around me all the time,
yeah,
and think I'm a one-track mind, but that's... I know in today's world, it's really hard to not focus on energy issues. And for me, I feel like I felt in many classrooms as I was growing up. I'm sitting in the back of the room waving my hands desperately, hoping somebody calls, because there's lots of questions going on, and I think that we have an answer that's probably better than any other answer that's available right now.
I couldn't agree with you more. And it seems like the economists are agreeing with us as well, as I see more and more other kinds of alternative energy projects go by the wayside.
Well, you know, if you just listen to all of the things that people say about some of the other alternatives, well, the prices will come down as we learn more, or you know, if we just could figure out the storage, or if we could just figure out you know, how to collect energy a little more efficiently. And I keep wanting to raise my hand and say, well, you know, us nukes, we've been working on this for a long time, and we've been trying to improve our processes and actually doing quite a good job at learning how to operate nuclear plants reliably, safely, and we've made some refinements in the design for these new generation plants. Look like they're going to be real winners.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
We don't have to sit around and say, if we just solve this one more problem, it's like, yeah, there are always more problems that we can solve, and we're working on it, and it's getting better. But in the meantime, we already have a market-ready solution. We don't have to wait for it to be marketable. It's there right now.
Well, yeah, but the only problem is that we've somehow managed to erect a barrier that's going to take about 4 years to pass through to get somebody to approve the construction of a plant that's already been licensed in the case of an AP1000.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we're making the first step towards a more streamlined licensing process. And you know, if it works and there are no unexpected regulatory delays in the first round, then perhaps there'll be an opportunity for us to be more efficient, continue to refine the process.
Right. And, of course, the other thing that does give me optimism is the fact that the first ones are going to be a very diligent, careful, step-by-step process. But as we start to make them more routine, it won't take 4 years after the first one to get the second one done. It won't take, you know, 4 more years to get the third one done. They won't be in series after that.
Yeah, I think.
And the inspectors that you have watching the construction have never seen, by and large, have never seen construction of a nuclear facility, with the exception possibly of Unit 1 down in, oh, help me, which one is that?
Browns Ferry.
Thank you, Browns Ferry. I was getting ready to say the name of the wrong plant, and I didn't want to mix the two together. Yeah, with the exception of Browns Ferry Unit 1, they've never seen nuclear construction before. Because they basically went through Browns Ferry Unit 1 and ripped out all the controls and rebuilt new, so there was plenty of opportunity to see, you know, construction of a nuke site there, and they did a lot of that. But once you get used to what you're looking at, if you will, then it's much easier with the fourth and fifth one to recognize, you know, what is good quality, what works, you know, this is the way I've seen it before, and this is what it's supposed to look like, and, you know, the anomalies are easier to spot and iron out.
Yeah, I do know that the NRC's got a very aggressive training program, and I wouldn't be surprised if some NRC inspectors aren't going to spend some time in Finland or France and maybe even some of the Asian plants and watching the construction there during the next few years.
No, I don't doubt it. Their training program is not only top-notch, but they're trying to position themselves as one of the top federal hiring departments as well, and they're doing a pretty good job of it.
I've talked to a few NRC folks about their, I think 2 years in a row they've received awards for being the top federal workplace.
I think that's really exciting. It's hard for me to picture. I think about federal jobs and I think about bureaucracy, so it's really hard for me to picture getting an award for being one of the top federal jobs. I'd be intrigued to talk with NRC people and find out what that means to the guys that are actually doing the work.
Yeah, well, that award,
that very fascinating.
That award comes from the employees themselves, that they do polls among all of the federal agencies. And so the employees are the ones that think it's a good place to work. But, you know, speaking as a longtime federal employee, there are good places to work in the federal government, and we're not all bureaucratic. And one of the things that I really wish that we could get back to is the idea that used to happen was that there is such a thing as good government, and there's such a thing as things that the government must do and cannot, you know, hire somebody, contractor or whatever,
right,
to do for
them. Can't delegate to anybody.
Right. I mean, you know, regulatory, you know, the referees and industries should be federal employees. You shouldn't hire out, you know, very much in the way of regulatory or rule setting or quite honestly, carrying guns either.
It seems like it's awfully easy for the people that work at utilities and stuff like that to assume that the regulator is the bad guy. But in order to keep a healthy, flourishing nuclear industry, it really takes both. It takes the public confidence that the regulator is doing their job and that there are checks and balances in the whole process. And it is possible and feasible to work with the resident inspectors at the station and the people coming through on audits and stuff like that with the attitude of they're just doing their job, and since I'm doing my job in a quality manner, I don't need to be afraid of them. I can work with them and say, here, this is what we've done, this is what we've accomplished, and, you know, let me show you how good I know we are.
Yeah, I guess it's only speeders that get nervous every time they see a police officer behind them, right?
I don't know that that's the case.
No, and, you know, the idea of checks and balances is important. I think that the people that designed our government and wrote the Constitution were quite cognizant of the fact that human beings have weaknesses, and it's good to have second checks and balances and give and take, and that's not exactly efficient per se, but you know, that's the way it works. And John should be joining us back. Hello, John.
Hey there.
Yeah, I dropped you off because I was hearing some background noises from.
Oh, I thought I put it on mute. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. But so we were talking about the notion of regulators and the importance of the checks and balances. That in order for us to really do our job effectively, we have to have people recognize that we have an independent regulator who is doing their job and helping build the public confidence and trust.
Yeah, they have a very important and demanding job, and you really have to respect this job that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has and has to do for us. And you know, once in a while I'll be critical of specific things that I see happening or will be reporting on a story that where I disagree with how something was done, but you know, from a 50,000 foot level, they do an incredible job. And And it's a very difficult task. I mean, they provide more oversight of an industry than any other federal agency. You know, not even our food supply, which is kind of ironic when you think about it. The nation's food supply is inspected probably 1/100th of the amount that 20% of our electrical generation capacity gets inspected.
Well, I think that the percentage would be a lot different if you realize that. I just read an article today about the FDA. And according to the article, they have enough inspectors so that in order to visit every facility that handles food, it would take them 1,900 years to visit every facility. On the other hand, we have two resident inspectors at every nuclear power plant.
Full time.
Right.
Right.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Full time resident inspectors.
Yeah.
So, it's hard to imagine how you do the math to compare two full-time resident inspectors to a visit every 1,900 years.
Well, there's a lot of other things that come into play for that, too. You figure the farmers who are providing our food, you don't want to punish them by making them pay for the inspectors as well, considering the margins that they work with. And nuclear basically pays for the inspectors that are there at the utilities and stuff like that. They have enough margin, if you will, that they pay for their own inspectors, they pay for their own waste disposal. You know, there's enough energy that can be achieved out of the uranium and enough electricity that can be delivered to the customer and marketed and paid for that they can pay for their own waste stream, they can pay for their own inspectors, they can pay for their own quality and stuff like that. It's not like it's hidden costs somewhere else.
Well, that is one area where I do have some challenges with the way the NRC has been set up, because by design, it is set up so that really only very large facilities can afford to be regulated, because they do have to pay. It's a per license, a per reactor fee, and
right,
I believe
not a per output or per megawatt. It's per, you know, facility.
Right.
The little tiny facilities that would not be profitable on a huge scale can't afford the licensing fees, and I know that's one of your pet peeves, Rod. So.
Well, it is a pet peeve, because I think that there are, you know, the way that we're structured is is the only reactor can be a large reactor, and there are some markets where small reactors are the right size for that market. And John, I think that you've made some positive comments on your show about smaller reactors recently.
Yeah, absolutely. There are definitely applications, not just for electrical power generation, but for heat sources, for industrial processes. You know, this possibility of a hydrogen economy in 20 to 25 years. You know, nuclear reactors, particularly high temperature gas reactors, are very efficient at splitting water molecules apart and creating hydrogen gas. It's one of the more cost effective ways to create hydrogen. So, you know, there's a lot of different applications for small heat generators. And I said maybe the next round we'll be able to streamline and change the process for the better. You know, maybe we get into a situation where smaller reactors are able to be produced on an assembly line type of arrangement or facility, where instead of paying for per reactor for the regulation, you're paying for a group of reactors that are all identical.
Right. And if the smaller reactors are designed so that they can be competitive, having a full-time inspector would be a very boring assignment for that inspector, because the reactor should be something that someone could go do a full inspection in just a few short hours.
So what do you fellows know about the status of the Galena, Alaska proposal for their nuclear battery, so to speak? They were going to have a reactor installed that they'd get some small amount of power out of it. Does anybody remember the numbers?
Yes, it's 10 megawatts electric from a liquid sodium-cooled reactor,
and
where the reactor would have about a 30-year life without refueling.
And it's buried in the ground, right?
Yeah, it's buried about 60 feet underground, where
so the
core is.
So the last news articles that I saw talking about it was Galena was trying to do some kind of negotiation with the NRC over how much security they'd need and what their operating expenses would have to be, whether they'd have to have a permanent resident inspector or not, because they said, you know, it's buried underground, we don't need to operate it, we don't have to do anything with it, and because we all know each other, if somebody came over trying to dig up the reactor that was over in the center of town, I think we would know.
Right.
Do we really need to have a permanent security force 24 hours a day? I mean, come on now.
Right, and it's a pretty isolated place. You would see them coming if somebody came. Now, and there are other folks. The Galena reactor is one designed by Toshiba called the 4S. It's not, by the way, the one that's running around the internet that talks about a 200-kilowatt reactor.
Oh, yeah, I think you were the one that sent me the link to that I shared with a couple of buddies. That's one of those urban legends. It's a nuclear urban legend.
And it keeps coming around, because I just saw it posted on a new site the other, like, 2 days ago. There's also a company called NuScale, and NuScale meaning power on a different scale. I believe their reactor is going to be a natural circulation light water reactor designed to produce about 70 megawatts thermal, 25 or so megawatts electric. And then there's the Hyperion reactor, which is also, you know, touted as a nuclear battery in that it has no moving parts in the core. I think it's somewhere in the 20 megawatts electric, or they would assume that it would be 20 megawatts electric. They haven't actually figured out what kind of heat system they're going to use to convert the heat into usable power, though. One of my quibbles with all these people that call their plants nuclear batteries is that you ask them, well, what's the conversion into electricity? And it's usually a steam plant.
Yeah.
Having operated a steam plant for a number of years, I can tell you that we worked a lot harder to maintain the steam plant than we did the nuclear plant on board submarines.
Well, you bring about another point is if it is a light water reactor, or a heavy water reactor for that point, if it's a water cooled or water moderated reactor, then you're automatically imposing the need for very heavy four genes that will hold a high amount of pressure. And then when you increase the mass of the components, then you have to increase the mass of the support structures that they rest on and the seismic restraint system and et cetera, et cetera. And so the plant becomes larger and more costly as the amount of steel and concrete goes up. And there are fewer places in the world where large forgings like that can be made, and so you impose bottlenecks on the material supply chain for the construction materials.
Yeah, so immediately, as soon as you pick one of those designs, your next step is to get in line for the forgings because you're going to be waiting years.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. The good thing is if you do have a smaller plant, the forgings are small, and I mean, there's enough difference in the forging size that you do open up a significantly larger body of suppliers.
Yeah, that was my point. The smaller plants, you can, you know, there are many, many more people who can make the pressure vessels for smaller plants.
Right, right. Because the real bottleneck right now is in the super large forgings. I think that Japan Steelworks, their limit is, or their advantage is, they can do something up to 700-ton vessel in a single forge. There are other places that can do like 400 tons, but they have to maybe weld two pieces together, which is a complex process, but it was one that was used in the early stages of reactor development.
Hey, can I swap topics on us for a second?
Go ahead.
Hey, John, you did the ANS meeting. When I go to the ANS meetings, I usually do the public information tracks and public speaking, how to, you know, address nuclear issues with members of the public. What track did you do, and then what kind of other stuff do you throw in when there's nothing going on in the track that you usually hang out in?
Great question. Well, I'm really involved in the education and training division, and so I tend to be engaged in that track. I went to the plenary and a number of things associated with the education and training division track. One of the things that I have gotten involved with in the past is, and I didn't do it this time just because of my schedule, but we hold a student design competition, and I've been a judge for the student design competition. And that's a really neat experience because there's student design teams from all over the United States submit designs, and then they get narrowed down, and then the top two graduate teams and the top two undergraduate teams present their designs to a final panel.
Designs for what?
Anything related to nuclear technology, engineering and technology. And so the two winners last time I did it was down back in December or November in Washington, D.C., and one was for a underground high-temperature gas reactor design that was very unique. And another winning design was for this is probably beyond my area of expertise, but it was for a neutron detector in a research laboratory that was using a crystal type that had not been used before. So it was just all kinds of very innovative work, and it's great to see young people getting into the business and coming forth with such impressive work.
Young people like what? Are we talking grad
college
students or?
And undergraduate and graduate.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's always fun. That's usually on Monday or Tuesday, Monday afternoon or Tuesday. So, the one thing I shared some observations with some friends while we were there is that we're a little bit disappointed. And I say this from the perspective of somebody who has been attending ANS meetings pretty regularly for the last couple of years, it seemed like the plenary presentations were pretty much repeat of what we've heard before. The same people or same group of people presenting the same topics.
Okay.
Now, in all fairness, as I said, I've been a pretty consistent ANS meeting goer for the last couple of years because I'm on some committees that require me to be there on Sundays, and my committee meetings are mostly all day on Sunday, and so I'm always there for Monday morning for the plenary discussions. But it would have been nice to see something a little different, a little out of the box. On the positive note, Don Hintz is the outgoing president, and he's had an effort for the last year to increase the amount of industry involvement in the American Nuclear Society, because historically it's been dominated by national laboratories and the academic community. And I think we've made some good progress in that direction in getting more industry involvement in the meetings. I think we still have a long way to go.
And what makes the difference? How do you get the industry involved instead of the research labs?
We actually Don Hintz put together a task force, and he put an industry leader in charge of it, John McGahey, who's the president of Entergy Nuclear, and he was in charge of the task force, and they had a number of initiatives, and I can't tell you what they were off the top of my head, but I think just from walking around and interacting with people, I think the industry was better represented than they have been in the past.
Well, one of the things I've heard, having gone to a lot of the meetings, was the industry didn't feel there was much payback for them sending people to the meetings, because, I mean, I like the ANS, and I think there's some really great people there, but quite honestly, the meetings are pretty darned expensive when you got to pay your own bills.
They are very expensive, and that's some, you know, again, talking in groups of friends, we really wish that there was a way to, you know, for one thing, you're traveling across the United States, so the meetings are either on the East Coast or the West Coast, so, you know, why not pick places in the middle of the country where everybody can get one flight rather than always having to take two or three segment air travel flights to get where you got to go. And they are expensive. You know, it's like, I don't remember the exact amount, but it's like $700 or $800 just to go to the conference. And then you have to pay for your hotel and everything else. So it is an expensive undertaking to participate. So, there are other opportunities, though, that are not as expensive. Some of the divisions have meetings at different times of the year. For example, there's a utility working conference that's being held in August down in Florida, which will be focused on utility issues. There's a conference.
That's one of my favorite ANS meetings, by the way.
Is it?
It's held at Amelia Island Plantation, which is a great place to visit.
Yeah. There's another, every other year, there's a conference on education and training called the Conti Conference, and that one is held, it's also held in Florida. It's held in Jacksonville, and that'll be in February of 2009, and that's a really good conference. Again, it's very focused, and that tends to draw a large percentage of folks from the industry. So you don't have to go to the annual meeting or the winter meeting to be involved. There are a lot of other ways to be involved with the American Nuclear Society.
You know, going back to Don Hintz, he's one of the real visionaries in the nuclear industry who's probably not gotten enough credit for adding value to his stockholders or his company stockholders, because he was the guy who started the idea of the large established companies going out and purchasing the plants that were owned by utilities who only owned one plant. And I think that the first one he bought for his company was one that probably cost less than the value of the fuel that was stored on site.
That's correct. That would be Pilgrim Nuclear Plant. The real estate that the plant sits on is worth far more than the company paid for the plant. And the fuel that was in the reactor is probably worth more than the company paid for the plant. Of course, that was back in the days when the investment community and the traditional thinking was that nuclear plants were not worth very much because they would
nobody
be phased out.
Nobody wanted to own the liability.
Right.
So the liability basically underwrote the value of all the hardware and infrastructure that was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wrote a blog entry today about a plant that I didn't know much about. I'd heard the name before, the Zion Nuclear Plant in ComEd.
Yeah.
What used to be ComEd's territory now, I guess, is Exelon owns the site. And there are two licensed 1,000-megawatt Westinghouse reactors sitting on, I guess, Lake Michigan, maybe?
I don't recall. I don't think it's on a lake. Maybe on a reservoir. I don't remember, to be honest with you. But I do remember the story of the science station.
Well, share it with me. I'm trying to learn more because these plants got shut down in 1998 because the company decided it was too expensive to replace their steam generators. And they haven't been dismantled. They're still sitting there in seemingly reasonably good shape.
Yeah, there were a number of performance problems, equipment performance and human performance problems at the plant at the time. And there was also some very contentious labor relations between the company. Then at that time it was Commonwealth Edison. And company, after weighing all the things they needed to do to get the plant back online, whether it was human performance issues, whether it was labor relations issues, and whether it was equipment issues, they made the decision that it was going to be not going to be cost effective for them to put the effort into it, and so they made the decision to shut the plant down.
Yeah, it was like an overnight kind of deal because we picked up consultants that were working at Zion. I was working for utility then, and we were working on a project. We got consultants that left Zion. Basically, it was overnight. It's like, oh, sorry, the money's not there. We're not going to do anything with it. And people that had signed 6-month and 1-year contracts, you know, found themselves a week later job hunting.
Yeah. But here's the thing. I do economic analysis on my day job. And I always like to remind people that the answer always depends on the assumptions you put into the model.
Right.
And that decision was made in 1998 when natural gas cost $1.80 per million BTUs. It costs over $11 per million BTUs now. It was also made at a time when the assumption was that the NRC would not be providing any license extensions. Right now, nearly every plant that actually does has gone through the process has received their license extension. So they thought that the steam generator replacement had to pay for itself by 2013 when the plants would be shut down, because that was the end of their 40-year lifetime. So it seems to me worthwhile to ask, is it time to go back and redo that economic evaluation and say, does it make economic sense today, knowing what we know today?
I don't know. It'd be interesting to talk to somebody who works for Exelon who may have some more insights into that question.
Well, that's what I'm doing right now. I'm a call out here.
Okay.
Anybody who works for Exelon and knows anything about Zion, I want you to call. I want you to contact me. I want you to
call the show right now, live.
Okay, send him an email.
Yeah, the email address is rod_adams@atomicinsights.com. And I want to hear. I want to know. I mean, let's think about this. This, you know, 2 1,000-megawatt reactors in today's market would probably cost somewhere around $3 to $6 billion.
Well, I may be able to dig up somebody, because I worked at the time at Indian Point, and Indian Point is actually technically very similar to the Zion plant. That's a couple of the design features of the Indian Point 3 reactor were very similar to Zion and had some unique features. But we ended up hiring some folks from Zion, and I haven't spoken with them for a while, but they may still be around the area, and I'll look them up and see if they'd be willing to join in on the conversation.
That would be a fun topic to be in on.
I mean, I'm not in the business of trying to tell a guy like John Rao how to run his company, but I can make suggestions. What the heck?
Yeah.
What would it hurt?
But
Rao or Rowe?
Rowe, yeah,
Rowe. Sorry.
Back on the American Nuclear Society. You know, I get a lot out of participating in the tracks, but I think I get even more out of the interactions with people while I'm there. One of the things, I had an opportunity to interface with a few folks who are working on the South Texas project, new reactor issues, whether they be workforce issues or training issues, and just talking to them, they really seem to be making some headway there, and I was very impressed with some of the things that I saw. They've got a state approved curriculum now for nuclear engineering technology that they're deploying at a number of community colleges around the state. They've got a number of enrollments. They've gotten state funding for scholarships. Really are doing a lot of good things there. And that's although it's being led by South Texas Project, the other companies who are considering building new nuclear plants in Texas are also involved. And I also heard that they have their reactor head. It's been cast. Somebody told me that they had seen an actual photograph of the first reactor head for one of the South Texas Project advanced boiling water reactor units.
Oh, cool.
So talking progress about, is being made.
Yeah.
Nerds get excited over the weirdest stuff. I just think that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, we're nukes. What can we say? We're a little geeky. No, I think Texas is a just an amazing state. I've been down there a couple of times talking with folks about new nuclear plants, and they really have a can-do attitude down there.
Yeah.
You know, hey, we need energy. This is a good source. We've been doing energy for a long time, and we want to be the leaders of the nuclear renaissance. I like to put together bits and pieces of hard-to-find stories, and one of the stories I've been covering for probably a couple of years now on the Atomic Insights blog is Amarillo Power, which is a kind of almost a phantom company. It's a real company. It's owned by a real person who's got lots of money named George Chapman. And I heard a couple of years ago that he had made a statement that he was going to have one of the first two reactors built in the U.S. And you don't hear too much about his project. And a lot of people said, well, where are you going to get water in Amarillo, Texas? Well, I just read an article in Business Week about T. Boone Pickens owns a 68,000-acre ranch in Roberts County, Texas. And apparently underneath this ranch is a huge aquifer. And Pickens wants to build an aqueduct to supply water to Dallas, Texas from Amarillo.
Hmm. I think I heard rumors about this aquifer like 15 years ago.
Yeah, so he's also planning to build a bunch of windmills out in that area of Texas too. And, of course, windmills and pumping water have always gone hand in hand in Texas. So I actually am putting two and two together, and I believe that T. Boone Pickens probably knows George Chapman, and they just aren't talking about where some of that water is going to go.
Yeah, and it's not like you really need a huge amount.
No, you don't.
And that's a little bit of a myth that you need vast quantities of water to run a nuclear plant. I mean, look at Palo Verde, the largest nuclear power plant in the United States.
In the middle of the desert.
In the middle of the desert, 50 miles from Phoenix. And most of their water comes from wastewater from the city of Phoenix that they treat. So.
Yeah, you certainly don't need much water, although some nuclear plants do consume a lot of water because of the way they're designed and they have the evaporative cooling towers.
That's right.
That was a design choice that was made, and the utility had plenty of access to very cheap water.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got the access, you know, what the heck?
Yeah,
I personally like the plants that use natural bodies of water, but I guess some people don't like that because of them pumping in organisms or something like that. I read something on the internet this week that said that the EPA actually made it illegal to build a new power plant of any kind that drew water from natural bodies of water. I think that was sometime in the early 1970s. And ever since then, you had to have an artificial body of water or the cooling towers.
Well, there's also a provision in that law that says that new plants or extensive upgrades of existing plants have to use best available technology to prevent intrusion or capture of aquatic life in the intakes of the plants.
Keywords and tricky phases make all the difference.
Right.
And the key to that best available technology phrase is it's not like the most affordable, the most economic, basically in federal courts they settled it as the best available. You know, if the technology is available, then you're supposed to be using it, whether it's cost effective or not.
Right. And there actually is some litigation that's pending to continue to argue that case, that there needs to be some financial consideration about what is best available in to the common good of the people that are being served.
Right, and the essence of the litigation was not against the utilities that we're proposing, but it was against the EPA, because the EPA was trying to use financial arguments for what the most reasonable cost was, and basically the public took the EPA to court and said that's not what the law says. It says best available. You're not allowed to consider cost as an option, and that's what the courts upheld, but it's not done with the process yet.
Right.
But you know, I evaluate technologies all the time, and you always have to have various measures of effectiveness. Best available, it might be the best at preventing the intrusion of a certain size of organism, but it hurts fish, you know, large fish somehow.
Right.
I've run into things where a certain technology is really good at getting rid of mercury, but not so good at getting rid of fly ash. You know, and you always have to balance and figure out what your measure of effectiveness is. And certainly, you know, in my purchasing, cost is always a factor for best. You know, that's the best car on the lot. But sure, there's nicer cars out there. That's the best car on the lot because that's the one that meets my budget.
Right, exactly. You have to optimize.
Yeah, it's interesting. But
Hey,
John,
folks,
you had to go.
Yeah, I'm going to have to leave y'all to have the rest of the conversation yourself. I have to get up very early in the morning to travel, and I still have lots to do before I can go to bed.
Well, you actually gave us 48 minutes, so I think we're probably going to go ahead and say that's probably a wrap for tonight.
Well, actually, I did have another question for you, Rod, after John
okay.
ends up leaving.
We'll let John take off.
All
take
right.
care, John. Thanks for...
Kelly, Rod, have a good week. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Came across a question on LinkedIn today that I was going to recommend you as one of the experts for. Oh, by the way, this is, how can we effectively promote nuclear energy production in the U.S.? And thought that it would dovetail nicely with your presidential award from ANS, since obviously that's one of your fortes. Wanted to know what your opinion was on it.
Yeah. I would say it's certainly one of my passions. I'm not sure if I'm very good at it yet, but I keep working at it.
Well, if you keep working at it long enough, you're bound to get good at it.
I like to think that. It's one of these things where I really keep pressing in trial and error, and fortunately, I'm in a situation where there's no risk to me to work hard at this task of sharing nuclear knowledge and promoting nuclear energy. My job doesn't depend on it. My family is not going to be impoverished because I keep pulling, doing this. So I think the best thing to do is to keep finding new people to talk to, try to build relationships with as many influential people and thinkers and decision makers and writers as you can. And, talk to people at schools and in your community and say, we all know that there's a problem. Good thing is today, the world is listening when you talk about energy. Sort of like the old commercials about, what was that?
E.F. Hutton.
E.F. Hutton, there you go. Now people listen. For a while, people didn't care too much because, gas was cheap and there was always other options.
Yeah, we'll shut down Zion and put in some natural gas-fired, something. It'll be cheap.
Right. Well, and today, like I said, natural gas costs $1.80 per million BTUs in 1998. Oil, during a couple of months of 1998, was under $10 a barrel. That's it's hard to imagine that something that important to the economy has gone up by a factor of 13.
I don't have much hope for for the current regime and current format of stuff for the resurrection of Zion, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, I don't have any hope for it happening real fast, but it's a conversation that it needs to start before they start tearing the thing apart.
Yeah, it is a worthwhile conversation. They're scheduled to start tearing it apart actually pretty soon. By about 2013, they're supposed to start decommissioning activities. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're certified defueled. They use the turbine generator for some electrical load stabilization stuff. They're not actually putting megawatts out there, but they're still connected to the grid, and the system operator uses them for something. But they've put them in safe store, which is, you know, long-term dry layup or whatever until they can begin decommissioning activities.
Yeah, and I'm not certain about safe store, whether or not there's any kind of chemistry control on the piping. That would probably be one of the biggest issues is what kind of chemistry situation has been in the primary piping. Other than that, it would seem to me the good thing about safe store is you haven't actually started cutting anything up.
It does not look like they've started cutting anything up. It looks like it's just sitting there.
Yeah, I know that there was a transfer of license for the actual plant itself to Energy Solutions, or a unit of Energy Solutions, to start planning for the decommissioning. And Energy Solutions, if you're not familiar with them, they're the folks that operate the the large low-level waste storage area in Utah, and they also operate Barnwell.
So yeah, I knew that name sounded familiar.
Yeah, it's an interesting company. It became named Energy Solutions within the last year, and they're a publicly traded company.
Yeah, they made some interesting news flurries when they went publicly traded and changed their name to Energy Solutions because of their CEO's commitment to, they don't serve just nuclear exclusively, but basically he was pro-nuclear and felt like serving the nuclear industry was something that was a public benefit. And so for a brief period of time, all the journalists wanted to get interviews with him because it was all, you know, that racy, you know, that weird pro-nuclear guy that actually thought he was going to build a business out of serving the nuclear industry and thought he was doing us a favor while he was doing it. It was actually pretty interesting to read the interviews with him.
Yeah. Well, I've always been of the opinion that it's not a bad career choice to be willing to do things that are important that nobody else wants to do. You know, if you decide you want to have a good, solid, long-term job and you're not particularly concerned about, you know, the smells, maybe being the engineer at a water treatment center is the right thing for you to do. You know that it's not going to go away.
Right.
And
there is value in doing that and doing it well.
Absolutely. Well, Kelly, I want to thank you for your time tonight, and hope that we get together again very soon.
It's always great to be here. Thank you for the invite, Rod.
All right, take care.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
I also wanted to end this show with a thank you. One of you, a listener for the Atomic Show, took me out to dinner the other day. Appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity of meeting someone in person who listens to the show. Thanks a lot.
Hi, everybody. This is Wayne Termel asking you to join me for the Working Week. Not the whole week, because neither of us has that much time, but for the Working Week podcast. That's the weekly digest of research, news, and opinion from the pages of managementissues.com. And that's the world's leading site for business, management, and human resources. My guests and I will talk about the news that matters to those of us just trying to survive the working week. That's workingweek.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today.
Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.